better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is January the 13th, 2016, and this is episode 1708 of the Survival Podcast. And I've got a good one on for you today. Returning guest, but a guy that was on the show so long ago. So very long ago that many of you probably have never even known that he's been on the show, but I bet you many of you have heard of him. His name is Chris Martinson. He's here today to talk about his new book called Prosper. It's about resilient living. Chris is kind of a futurist type of guy. He's also the creator of something called The Crash Course. That's been around for just about as long as the Survival Podcast has been around. Chris is a guy that, honest to God, has paralleled me in the development of his business at about the same rate, speed, and growth that I have, kind of a contemporary. When I started, he was just starting out. I mean, it's almost like we started within, I think, weeks of each other online in earnest. And it's great to have him come on the show today. I think he's got a lot of really great stuff to say, and Crash Course is a great thing for you to take. I think you can still do it online for free on YouTube, and it's not really a course. It kind of is, but it's not like a test or anything. And it's a great eye-opener. I think you'll really enjoy hearing from Chris today. Before we do that, though, let's hear from our sponsors. They do a lot to help take care of you by helping to make sure the show is here for you Monday through Friday, 5 days a week. Sponsor of the day number one today, KnifeKits.com. Knife Kits is a really great company. They've been with us a long time. When we vetted them for the sponsorship program, we checked all the blade forums and things like that, and they turned out to be a really great company with just a stellar reputation in the industry. And KnifeKits.com makes it easy for you to learn the skill of knife crafting. It really does for you, and maybe for you and your kids to learn that skill together. You can get basic kits that aren't much more complicated than doing, let's say, a model car that you would buy when you were a kid and glue together. You pick out some handle material, some bolsters, and things like that. If you're not sure what you're doing, they have books and DVDs. They also have great stuff where you can make things out of Kydex and learn that skill as well. America was a country that at one time had a hard line skill set. People could do things in their own home without calling a guy to fix the, you know, whatever it was that wasn't working in your home. Today, it seems like we've lost a lot of those skills, and one way to regain them is to start taking up small hobbies like this and learn these basic skills like fit and finishing, sharpening knives, etc. And hey, if you're a master bladesmith, they have some of the coolest exotic materials you can get your hands on. Check them out today at KnifeKits.com. Remember, they also do support the MSP, or Member Support Brigade, with a great discount for you. You can find out about that in the benefits section of your MSB. And sponsor of the day number two today is the awesome, illustrious Chef Keith Snow with HarvestEating.com, where he'll teach you to make cooking a life skill by focusing on technique over recipe. If you don't think cooking is a survival skill, brother, you've never lived on MREs for 6 months like I have. You get pretty creative in those situations. Being able to cook all the food that we talk about growing for ourselves and sourcing locally is a great way to enhance your quality of life and to save money. If you become a great cook, you're not going out to expensive restaurants. And Chef Keith has a lot of ways to help you do that. He has an awesome podcast. He has a really great YouTube channel. And right now, he's got some of the coolest sauces you'll ever find possible. Pasta sauces and new packaging that makes shipping a lot easier. Things like creamy basil, flame-roasted red pepper, sun-dried tomato, and rosemary. Soon he'll be moving things over to Amazon, but for now, just go ahead and check out HarvestEating.com for all of that and more. Remember, Chef Keith will help you make cooking into a life skill. Next up, let's take a look at the year that was the episode. The year, of course, 1708, because the episode is 1708. I've got three for you, as usual, from Alex Shrug today. We have the last veto of the English monarchy, sort of. We have teaching hospitals and teaching students. And we have Europe produces its own hard porcelain. I'm going to read teaching hospitals and teaching students. A Dutch botanist, Herman B., has published his theory on how inflammation works. His motto, simplicity is the sign of truth. It's a variation on Occam's razor. The simplest explanation usually is the correct one. Herman introduces the idea of teaching hospitals where doctors are taught by doing. This is also the year when Albrecht von Haller is born. He will become one of Herm's students, and he will be considered the father of modern physiology, which is the study of and function of living organisms. Later, Hermann's ideas on heat transfer will be used by Benjamin Franklin to invent his Franklin stove. My Take by Alex Shrugged. Although Hermann did significant work, he had a real talent for teaching students, and his students expanded on those ideas and methods. Education today is quite complex. Students are loaded down with facts, but rarely know how to judge the value of those facts. This is partly due to the German education system we use. But in the early 1920s, educators began to obscure learning, masking it with dense lingo and complex method. This prevents individuals from teaching themselves and apparently creates full employment for professional students. After all, if your average mother could teach a child, what would you have? You'd have a lot of mothers educating their children instead of being shut out by Common Core. FYI, crap is not a profanity. This is derived from the same name Thomas Crapper, who sold plumbing fixtures. You can figure the rest out from there. All right, so here's my deal. I completely agree with Alex's take on this, and I think it's even worse than it sounds, because it's an illusion. It's an illusion. The complexity in modern education that makes it like only a special person that went to college for 4 years and got certified as a teacher is qualified to teach the frickin' first grade is an illusion. All of the complexity is largely, I won't use the word crap, I'll use what it is. It's complete, total bullshit. There is no need for a person to have a college education to teach first grade or second grade or third grade or fourth grade. With some maturity and basic understanding of educational methodology, the reality is someone who got straight A's in fourth grade should be more than qualified to teach third. Seriously. And it is why you're seeing what's going on in modern education today. Common Core is an adaptation in modern education to try to further distance parents from their children. That's all that it is. That's 100% of what it is. Some of the founders have basically said it is to equalize learning so that some children don't have an unfair advantage. What's an unfair advantage? An unfair advantage in the mind of these people is a parent that gives a shit about their kids and helps them with their schoolwork and teaches them before they learn at school so that they're ahead of the curve. Common Core is an attempt to eliminate that by making learning so complex that it has to be done by a specialized person, and it also becomes largely freaking useless. And it's only one of many times that the public education system has done this. And it's all coming to an end. It's all coming to an end because the internet specifically enabled homeschooling and self-directed learning at such a high level that this time they went too far. Common Core is imploding across the country. Parents are pissed. Parents are absolutely pissed off, and they should be. And they're taking control of the situation back. But more and more of them are realizing as they attempt to do that, screw it. I'm just going to remove my child from this system in some way, shape, or form. And it's going to be an avalanche. It's going to be an avalanche. And I'm not the historical scholar Alex is, but I'll bet it won't be the first time something like that has happened when it comes to education. My Take by Jack Spirko. Next up, let me remind you, you can support the show. Join the Member Support Brigade. Go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on Members to learn more there. If you're military, law enforcement, Peace Corps, or a first responder like EMTs, paramedics, and firefighters, either active duty or prior service, you qualify for a discount. Email me with TSPC service discount in the subject line. Tell me about your service in one or two sentences. I'll get you that discount code. Please do that before, not after you join. And with that knocked out, let's go ahead and take a look at the plan of the week this week. It wasn't on Tuesday because Bob piked out, man, and didn't get me his plan of the week information over yesterday. But I pinged him, and they got it over me today. Plan of the week this week is the 4-in-1 apple tree. Bob offers these as large 10-gallon trees with heavy branching. Multiple budded semi-dwarf apple tree on M111 semi-dwarf rootstock includes Fuji, Gala, Granny Smith, and early summer red apple. If you need more variety from limited space, the multi-budded apple tree is the answer. Multiple budded apple trees will give you several fine selections of tree-ripened apples from the space of a single tree. Bobwell specializes in edible landscapes, plants, and trees, including fruit trees, berry plants, vine fruits, nut trees, as well as the hard-to-find specialty trees. Find this plant more at bobwellsnursery.com. Let me tell you what I think about these trees like this, these multi-graft. you want a big, well-branched, 10-gallon size tree if you're going to do multi-branch. If you are not really switched on with pruning, especially with pruning these trees, it is very important with your multi-graft trees to get the tree balanced out early on, and then it's a lot easier to control. So larger, more established trees are the way to go when it comes to this particular tree. A lot of times I actually prefer trees that are younger, you know, and smaller in size, because they're going to be less root bound and they're going to be more likely to get those roots into the ground well for you and have less circling root problems and things like that. In this instance, it's worth pulling roots apart to have that well established and balanced tree. So I'm glad to see that when he's offering these, he's offering them as larger trees. With that, let's get into the main topic of today's show, which, of course, is our special guest, Mr. Chris Martinson. Chris, again, is the originator of the concept called The Crash Course. It's also available as a book now, and he has another new book out called Prosper. It's about resilient living in a modern world full of shifts and new trends. With that, hey, Chris, man, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Well, thanks. It's good to be back.
I think it was probably 6 or 7 years ago was the last time I had you on. That's too long. Glad to have you back on. Before we get into the topic, which is resilient living today and your new book on the subject, for people that maybe didn't hear that first interview or haven't heard of Chris Martinson, can you give us kind of the introductory speech? Who are you? How'd you get into doing what you're doing?
Sure. Well, I'm the co-founder of website peakprosperity.com, and I've got a few books out and a video series. The most famously known one is The Crash Course. It walks through the three E's, which is the economy, where I focus most of my effort, but you can't understand the economy without understanding energy, and also the environment, things we take out and stuff we put back into the natural world. I put all three of those together into a view, and that view led me to change my life big time. So, you know, if your listeners want to, let's do the before and after story. Before I started being curious about what was really happening out there, I'd gotten a PhD and an MBA. I worked my way up through the big corporate world. I was vice president of a very large company, Waterfront House, Mystic, Connecticut. I started investigating what was going on as the stock market was crashing in 2000, 2001. Then, of course, 9/11 came along. I looked into that. I started connecting all sorts of dots, and I said, whoa, this is not what I thought. I'm not playing the game I thought I was playing. And one thing led to another, and by 2005, I'd quit my vice presidency. We'd moved my family into a little house in western rural Massachusetts, ditched the fishing boat for a kayak, just downsized everything and started a blog. So yeah, if anybody wants career advice, don't talk to me. I'm not the right guy. But the short story is I came across information, Jack, that changed everything about my life. What I do, what I value, who my friends are, everything changed. And here I am.
Can you kind of give us a recap for those who maybe haven't seen Crash Course, which I recommend everybody go take a look at, of your outlook for the future and kind of what you see now? Because you did that course a long time ago. I was saying during the intro segment today that our paths are very, very similar, you and I, and even in timeline. I remember when I was first starting the show, Crash Course, you sent me a copy of it, and I was like, wow, this is really interesting, and you had just really kind of gotten that under you yourself. So that's like 8-ish years right there. So has anything changed in the way you're viewing that and kind of bring that context forward?
Well, you know, a couple of things. First, I'm a little surprised at the slowness of the recognition among people. A lot of people say, oh, Chris, you know, you said there was going to be a crash, a crisis. Where is it? I'll tell you, it's here. You know, just open your eyes. What do you want? More people on food stamps? What do you want? More emerging markets crumbling? What do you want? You know, the ocean's dying faster? What do you want? You know, it's in retrospect, this is going to look quick, but it does feel to be taking some time. And this, the most surprising thing to me, Jack, is not the levers that have been pulled by the authorities to just keep this thing moving a little bit longer. It's the extent to which people have not woken up to it yet. In fact, most people still seem maybe even more willfully in denial or blind about what's really happening. Although, increasingly, I have to tell you from my perspective, love to hear yours, concerned, like getting really unhappy, agitated with how the world is going. Even if they don't know why, but for the curious, they know why. Like, you know, where should we start the conversation? There's so many things that are not right right now, that the fact that our media attempts to pretend as if everything's okay just creates a really yawning gap of dissonance, cognitive dissonance. Like, Jesus, really, you're saying that, but we're experiencing this. When can we have a real conversation?
Yeah, I mean, last night the president said in the State of the Union address that those who say the U.S. economy's in a downturn right now are basically lying. I don't know exactly what I said because I don't listen to any of those people anymore, but I kind of picked that up through Facebook today, and that is like, really? And then people believe that. Here's kind of how I look at this whole phenomenon. It is like entering a black hole, and that's why it seems slow, especially the economic component to it. People are like, where's the collapse? And I'm like, well, you don't understand is we're in the event horizon. And, you know, you if you know anything about that world, if you could actually survive a black hole, when you were in the event horizon, you wouldn't really notice anything as you're slowly being stretched out like a string. But once you get past a certain point, then you're immediately careening into the center mass at the speed of light. And we're in that. And it's a very long process of being stripped apart. And I think that's what's going on. And things like the, you know, economic stimuluses that they've done, the quantitative easing, these are little can kicks that maybe push you a little bit back higher into the event horizon, but you're still in there. And I think that's what's confusing people. And that's why we seem to have three types of people in my audience and in the world as a whole. The first are the people that don't have a clue at all. They don't know any of this stuff's going on. The second are the people that have awoken to it, and they go like batshit crazy with fear. Like, mm-hmm. They're freaked out. And then there's people that have realized, well, there's a lot of things you can do about it. And I'd say that's the core of the people that listen to me that say, hey, there's a problem that we need to address, and we can only do it for ourselves because no one's going to do it for us. And that's kind of the landscape that I see right now.
I agree. And I would put very similar observations on my end, and I would put one more sort of characteristic that I see heavily in my crew is that these are all people who can understand logic and math. Very heavy weighting.
Yeah.
For physicists, engineers, doctors, lawyers, people who've been trained in some logical or mathematical sort of a profession, because this is just math, right? And you say event horizon, when you say if I had to summarize everything that the crash course predicts in one word, it's unsustainable.
Yeah.
You can't have an infinitely expanding money system on a finite planet. Just a child could work out the fact that that's a problem. Well, that problem is now a predicament we're too far into the story with 220 trillion worldwide debt outstanding and compounding. And here we are. And, you know, I agree with that description you have of that third order of person, which is like, look, this is the world I live in. I don't get to choose, I was born now. So what am I going to do about that? And that's really where I think more and more people are having energy. And it's where this new book we're going to talk about comes in. It's really more about saying, listen, we've already described the problem. What are we going to do about it? And that's where there's a lot of territory to be, covered.
When I look at math, Chris, and money, I'd like your take on this. I look at it now. We've kind of hit this point where we've almost created the black hole ourselves. Like, once you create enough mass of something, it begins to collapse on itself. And everybody's all freaked out about hyperinflation, not so much because of the sheer amount of money that would have to be created to put us into a hyperinflationary state, like a Weimar Republic type thing. I just don't think it works anymore. You're in much more of just a collapsing in on itself mode. And if you add to that the fact that with U.S. economy, like 1% of us, and I'm not a socialist, I don't want to take anything away from anybody, but the mathematics are that 1% of the people are holding so much of the wealth that even if you did dump enough money into the economy, unless it moves, unless there's velocity of money within an economy, you're in this kind of stagflation state. And I just don't see us ever really coming out of that. I'm not saying there won't be inflationary problems and real inflation's higher than they say, but this concept that all of a sudden you're going to take a wheelbarrow full of money down to buy potatoes or something like that, I think the problem's much worse than that, because what I think they've been trying to do is everything they can to actually cause inflation, because inflation is growth in their eyes, and they can't do it.
Well, they can. And, of course, Japan already proved to us you can't do this. We're following the exact Japanese prescription. Japan's on whatever, its 12th or 30th QE program.
Yeah.
And they're still suffering. And the problem is Japan is the largest floating retirement colony on the planet, and they're losing population. You're not going to get robust growth out of an increasingly over 65-year-old population that's losing numbers.
Sounds like America. We're just a big island, right? I mean,
it's just how it works. But the money system demands that growth. And if they don't get that growth, the banking system's going to collapse. So let's be really clear about this. We are all we're all slaves to our money system, which is administered by the banking system. And our money system should be in service to us, but somehow it's upside down. And that's where it's really uncomfortable. And to your point, if you let a debt-based money system run long enough and you don't redistribute the wealth in some fashion, at the end of it all, and I can prove this to you in a spreadsheet, one person or entity ends up owning everything, and everybody owes them. That's how it works out.
They made the game called Monopoly for a reason, and that's exactly where it ends up. And you're seeing that, like, I'm not big on this redistribution through taxation thing or anything, but when you actually, the people that are consolidating the wealth are the people that produce the money, right? So it's like having your own money printing press and being able to, every time you print money, suck value out of the existing money. And that's what they're doing. And that's why this has gotten to be such a disparity. If you look at the consolidation of wealth, let's say in 1960 or 1980 compared to today, it's staggering. And I think the problem that we have is when people say wealthy in this country, especially the people that have kind of switched on to this problem but not at the mathematical level we're talking, they view people like you or me as the wealthy. And we are so far from the type of wealth that we're talking about here that it's preposterous to look at it that way. But they see anybody who lives in a nice house and is able to eke out a six-figure income as being, the 1%. That's not the 1%. That's becoming the middle class at this point.
Well, absolutely. Try the 1% by income. Try living on that in New York City. You'll discover you're not fabulously wealthy. And it's to hide the fact that it's not really the 1% at this point that's the problem. It's the 0.01%. Mm-hmm. And it's that concentration, but that's not even to pick on individuals. You have to understand there are entities out there now that supersede individuals that have trillions and trillions under management that's virtually untouchable because,
correct,
they're not subject to any of the same distribution laws that might happen, such as, the estate taxes or anything else. And even regular taxes,
yeah,
they've got such good lawyers.
Yeah, tax doesn't work because the wealthy don't own their money. They own the companies that own their money.
Right.
I mean, that's what nobody understands. I don't say nobody understands that because I think it's insulting to a lot of people. Most people that are of the concept that we can redistribute that wealth through a taxation system don't understand what I just said. They don't get it at all.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's where we're at. But listen, so this is why people are increasingly uncomfortable, because we're at the end stage of that system where the event horizon is here and things move quickly at the end.
Correct. And so before we go into that, can you break down your three E's for us so that people have a frame of reference? Because we're getting pretty high level pretty fast.
Yeah, so the economy is the first E. And in the economy, I'm really just looking at the money system. If you don't understand the money system and how money is created, you're not going to understand anything else that follows. And, listen, I made it all the way through high school, college, post, graduate, an MBA program. Nobody ever taught me how money is created in our banking system. It's not a hard concept, but it's an essential concept. So that's a big part of the first E, is really talking about that mechanism of modern fractional reserve banking, how it works. And if you get that, you can get to the conclusion of that, which is pretty clear, which is it either expands or it collapses. It really doesn't have a middle zone that's comfortable. And so, okay, that's fine. So we take that supposition once that's proved out that, okay, we have an economy based on money that always has to expand. What's the big deal? Well, now wander with me over to the second E, which is energy, because energy is not a derivative of the economy. It's upside down. The economy is a derivative of energy. You either have energy or you don't. If you do, you can have an economy. If you don't, you got nothing. Energy is the master resource. So I know oil prices are cheap right now. I'm actually staring at my screen looking at $30 a barrel oil here. But let's not lose the prices here. What matters is the quantity of high net energy oil that we're getting out and bringing to market. And what's been happening over the last 10 years is we've been slowly swapping out and draining the pools of really high quality energy and replacing it with increasingly lower quality, increasingly very expensive oil. And, you know, we're draining one and filling it with another. And it's so that expensive oil turned out to be, unpopular with an economy saddled with $200 trillion of debt. So we started having an economic hiccup. So now we have a price hiccup in oil. So that energy story is really important. And I said the key piece, net energy. If you understand what net energy means, which means the energy that's left after you've used energy to get energy, that net part is what we run everything on, including this podcast and the food that's in my fridge and how everybody gets to work, all that stuff. So that's a big story. And then the environment, I'd look at resources that are out there. You know, in just 150, 200 years of industrialization, we're down to digging pits that are like a mile deep just to get the last little grubby 0.2% copper out of the ground. We're out of high quality ore deposits in pretty much everything we care about, except maybe iron. And we can look into the future, Jack, and see things like silver. All the known deposits of silver are going to be completely exhausted in 20 years. So that story of depletion, we're seeing that everywhere. And then, of course, in the environment, we're also exhausting other things like water tables, soil nutrients, species, you name it. Like we're just doing things that I think as a person trained in the sciences and particularly biological sciences, it's a bad idea when you wreck your ecosystems. It's just not good. And so, you know, one little fact is this, here's one that weirds me out big time. Phytoplankton in the ocean, which gives us half the oxygen in the world, is down 40% in the last 40 years. Right? Is that a problem? I don't know.
It sure sounds like a problem.
Maybe we should be looking at it.
Yeah, it sounds like a bigger problem than the temperature of the Earth might go up a degree. It sounds like a huge problem. I mean, that is the base of the ecosystem for not only the ocean, but the planet.
Yeah.
That seems important to me, and yet you hear nothing of that. And that's why I grow weary of some so-called environmentalists, because they're single-issue people that they just think if we tax carbon, we'll fix this. And I think that's as ridiculous as thinking if you tax wealthy people, you can end poverty. I think they're equally preposterous. And when you start thinking that way, you ignore things like what you've just said. That's just, I know a lot about environmental problems, and I want to do whatever I can to fix them, but that's a statistic I had never heard.
Well, it's out there, and the scientists I talk to are studying it. They're all freaking out, but who will listen to them? Phytoplankton, who cares, right? Mm-hmm. You know, is the stock market up? So it's just the sign of our times, but increasingly, you know, people are uncomfortable with that. So that's the three E's. I put those three E's together, and there's a fourth E that ties it all together, and that's understanding exponential growth. You know, we're humans, we're wired to understand linear growth, but exponentials sort of confuse us, you know, because and we live surrounded by exponential stuff like gravity, right? Mm-hmm. So you ever see somebody like, you know, letting themselves down to the ground in a linear fashion, that's easy. But if somebody slips on the ice, it's a surprising moment. You know, exponential functions are crazy that way. And so we're surrounded by all these exponential functions, exponentially increasing levels of debt, decreasing levels of soil, increasing levels of species loss, decreasing amounts of water in aquifers. It's astonishing. And we're surrounded by them. And so when we put all those together, I just say, look, the path we're on is unsustainable. It's going to change. And my analysis leads me to conclude that the thing that breaks first, fastest, and most profoundly is going to be the economy, by which I actually mean the financial system. That breaks. I think there's a very high chance of having a complete financial accident at some point in the next it's somewhere in the next 10 years, but could it happen tonight? Sure. Could it happen in 9 years? Sure. But at some point, unpredictable, a financial accident where, you know, it's one of those long 3-day weekends and people come out on Monday and the banks aren't open and everything changes.
So when we look at things like that, you know, I kind of teased on the people who are just freaking out, right? But mm-hmm. You can understand why people who have never been exposed to this, when they first are freaking out. I remember the first time I understood unfunded liabilities. I stopped, you know, that was probably 15 years ago, but I stopped looking at just the debt and the unfunded liabilities, and I went, holy crap. And I had my own, you know, kind of very brief Chicken Little experience. So the key to this, in my opinion, and I know yours is too because you wrote a book on it, is developing a resilient lifestyle. So can you talk about what you mean by resilience and the importance of developing it before the problem, not during or after?
I'd love to. So, excuse me, I had the same Chicken Little moment. It's why I live where I live now. But after a few years of increasing my own resilience and cutting my living standard in half, but also improving my quality of life at the same time, I discovered that I would most willingly run towards this life I've discovered for myself and created for myself rather than running from something. But let me be honest, I was running at first. You know, that's what got me off my duff and doing something different. So to be resilient simply means the ability to respond or rebound from some sort of an insult or injury. And we don't have a very resilient financial ecosystem right now, and that's often what freaks people out. Like, most people are unaware that there's maybe 3 to 5 days of food in any community, and unless the trucks continue to roll, you will run out of food in any major city very rapidly if it gets cut off. And so what we have is a cost-effective means of delivering food, but not a resilient one, because we don't have inventories anymore. We have a just-in-time global integrated system for everything from underwear to ammunition to food to you name it. And so I think a reasonable person could say, wow, if that got interrupted, life would change in a hurry. And so that's the fear part. But, you know, to be truly resilient now is something that I think is completely attainable for a lot of people. Not, you can never be perfectly resilient, but thoroughly attainable if they are willing to make some meaningful changes in their lives.
Okay, and can you maybe go into some of those changes that people should be making in their lives and how that plays into the future that we both see as having a lot of potential for heartache?
Absolutely. So, you know, after writing The Crash Course, Adam and I spent a lot of time. We were hosting seminars where people would come and spend 3 days with us. We have a large online community, our own personal lives and examples. And what we did was start to glean what are the things that people could really do, because it's the most common question we get asked after people come out of The Crash Course, deer in the headlights look, and they ask, what should I do? There's no easy answer for that. Because, you know, it depends how old you are, how much money you have, where you live, your skills, you know, all kinds of things. But some general principles came out of that. And listen, the first thing people usually care about, and I think rightly so, is how can I protect my money, my wealth? I've got some savings, maybe a lot of savings or wealth, and they see this world that could just take it from them. You know, that's what Wall Street does best. And so they're worried about protecting that. So in this new book, Prosper, that Adam and I wrote, that's the biggest chapter we've got on in terms of the forms of capital that we think people should invest in. But, you know, really, like, figuring out your finances, making sure if you have money in the market, make sure it's managed really well by people who actually understand the risks out there, you know, like MF Global stealing your client accounts kind of risks that now exist. Right. And making sure that you're protected well from downside, making sure that you don't have too much money in any one of the banks, making sure it's out of the big banks who have the most derivative exposure, having some cash out of the bank in case of that sort of banking holiday moment. Things like that. We have a lot of very prescriptive advice just around finances alone. But none are so poor as those who only have money. And we don't even remotely begin to think that just having money, no matter how much, is going to make you resilient. You have to push into other areas to increase your resilience.
Can we explore some of those now?
Sure. So in this book, we have eight forms of capital that we'd like to direct people to. Financial capital is one. Now, if I swiveled around and looked out my window, I would see another form of capital, living capital, which is the large garden I've got where I spend money every year to import high-quality compost and build the soils up. So I'm increasing the living capital in my yard. I've got beehives. I've got an orchard. I'm constantly planting things to increase the abundance for not just myself but all kinds of critters and animals and bees and bugs that would live out there around. And so I'm using my financial capital to build the living capital. Now, living capital is also my health. So Adam and I are big proponents of being healthy and eating really well and exercising well and doing things so that you have your own living capital and your body is well supported, spending money to help attain those goals. So that's our second form of capital. Third one, of course, your listeners will be very familiar with, like ours, which is material capital. And these are the things you own. So the material capital in my house could include the solar photovoltaic panels I've got, the solar thermal panels I have, which heat my hot water, the extra wood stove I've put in, the extra insulation in the house. These are all material investments I've made, which are going to either give me greater resilience in the future or reduce my need to spend cash in the future on things like heat and light and power and stuff like that. So material capital is another place we can really advise people to move into. And the book is full of fairly concrete examples, as well as the framing for it. You know, we got a guy on our site who comes out of a military background, and he introduced for us the concept of crying once when it comes to buying things. And that means, you know, you just spend the most money you can to buy the best possible thing you can, cry that one time, and then you're not crying all the other times as you replace the garbage that just sort of breaks on you constantly. So cry once, you know, spend well, you know, really get full enjoyment out of something rather than partial enjoyment out of some piece of junk that you have to replace soon. So those are the first three is financial, material, living, social capital, really important. Who you know and how well you know them are going to be really important determinants, not just to your future resilience, but to your current happiness. We've got lots of examples like coming out of Zimbabwe. There were people in Zimbabwe who saw that currency devaluation coming. They bought gold. They bought stores of food. And the crisis lasted for 9 years. And so their preparations lasted one or two at most. Mm-hmm. And so what defined the people who did the best in years 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 were the people who had the best social connections. They knew where to get stuff, who they could trust, how to get things done. Even though the economy was in full collapse, they were still able to maneuver and get things going like that.
Very cool. I also look at what these things can do for us today. So, for instance, one of the things I love about that eight forms of capital, and I'm assuming that you garnered that from Ethan Rowland. That was the first place I've ever heard about it anyway, but is the concept that if we move capital from one form to another, we can often shelter it from its two greatest enemies, which are inflation and taxation. So if I earn money, the government taxes it. If I put it into a big house, the government taxes the house. If I put it into a coffee can, and I'm with you, I think we should have capital reserves, but if I put it all into a can, then every year the inflation monster takes a piece of it away. So the best place I can put it is into some sort of an asset that pays me dividends, like your stove, or the best place, in my opinion, when you have the money and the space for it, is into appreciating assets that are untaxed. So an example of that is a tree. If I plant a chestnut tree or an apple tree, not only does it produce food for me, it provides me with this huge resource, but it also grows over time and its value increases. And if you were looking at two properties and one was 10 acres and it was treeless and just a big pile of grass you had to mow, and the other one was full of you know, marketable timber or food producing trees or what have you, it's going to be much more valuable to a buyer. But tax assessors generally don't assess taxes on things like that. I know in some places they're starting to, but in general, if you live out in the country and plant a bunch of trees, your place just looks like a woodlot. And that moves that capital into that living capital where it's very hard for the government to quantify its value, and inflation can't touch it because inflation actually makes its value go up.
Well, exactly right. And that's a great point, because we all know that as governments get into the desperate stage, they just tax whatever they can. It's just, listen, there's no exception to that rule so far in history. So I don't think ours is going to behave any better.
In our next segment, you'll love this. We just covered the fact that in the 1700s, Peter the Great in Russia taxed beards. And it led to a Cossack rebellion, right? So, I mean, they even taxed beards in the past.
Listen, anything that seems like value, whatever, it doesn't matter.
Some place in Maine had a view tax. They decided property was worth more than view, and they assessed it on a blind guy.
Listen, we're going to laugh about it, but it's good. We're going to be crying later, because this is what happens. Look, governments get in over their heads, and they want to take stuff. And so you touched on a number of really important things. The first is, yes, we did draw upon the work of Gregory Landua and Ethan Rowland in their Eight Forms of Capital, and they're, yeah, fully acknowledged in the book, and I've worked with both those guys. They're just wonderful. And the second is that a lot of these things that people are going to do, if they follow the prescriptions in the book, this isn't about living in fear for some future state that may or may not come. If you do these things, you will be surrounded by more beauty. You will have greater wealth. You'll sleep better. You'll be healthier. You'll have better relationships. All of these things are going to benefit you today. So that's a big key part of our philosophy for Adam myself, is we're not doing this stuff because we want to, hunker down in case, like we're waiting for a whip to fall on our backs. You know, that's not the point. The point is live as well as you possibly can, but if you can do that and be more ready and more resilient than the next guy for when this crisis is going to unfold further, why not, right? And so one of the keys to that, another form of capital that's really critical to us in the book is this idea of emotional capital. And what do we mean by that? Well, we all know people who weather adversity really well, and other people who fall apart, at the drop of a pin. And so we've seen this happen where in the past, in fact, it's happening right here in America right now. Suicide overtook car deaths in 2010 as the leading cause of unnatural death, as it were. And white people now are dying earlier and often in large measure due to alcohol. And so this is happening because already times are a little bit tight and it's proving to be hard on people, and they're reacting to it in a way that's killing them, either directly through suicide or more slowly through alcohol. But people are checking out in other ways too. They're numbing themselves. They're playing too many video games, sleeping too much, eating too much, doing too little of all of those things, whatever. And this speaks to a lack of emotional resilience. And so we spent a lot of time talking about what that really means and how you can begin to develop your emotional resilience, because it's not going to be the economic crisis that hurts people as much as their reaction to it for most people.
Yeah, and you bring something up there with the emotional resilience that's very concerning for me as I look at the generation just behind you and I. We're about the same age. And as you keep going back younger and younger, it seems like we have maliciously removed resilience from our children. And yet, when I say children, it's misleading, because many of those children are now 30-something years old that have grown up with this, you can't run and throw rocks anymore. I won't go down that rat hole. You know what I'm talking about.
I do.
This audience. And those people are going to be our age in another 15 years, dude. And they may very well be dead center of the crosshairs of this thing, because that's kind of the timeline I see as this long, slow collapse heading for.
I couldn't agree more. And this speaks to at least one of the other forms of capital. We call it knowledge capital, which is both the things you know, but then the experience you've had in operating that. And where your knowledge and experience overlap, you get that sense of mastery. I would agree with your assessment that a lot of the people in the generation behind us have been denied the experiences that they need in order to begin developing that personal sense of mastery. It could be as simple as just how you make mac and cheese out of a box, or it could be something, more profound, which is, what does it mean? Like, where's your edge? What does risk feel like? How do you bounce back after you fall off a jungle gym? There are a variety of skills that only come from experience, and we've denied experience. And so, I come from a long line of people who went to college, and I went to way too much of it. My own daughter's 21. She went to about a year and a half, we homeschooled. And she went to about a year and a half, maybe almost 2 years of community college, and said, this is a bogus way of learning. It's all fear-based, and nobody's really intrigued, and nobody can tell me how this pertains to real life. And so now I have her working, I found a great position for her working with a guy, and she's doing this whole entrepreneurial, she's paid, not an internship, but she's working with a guy who's helping a small company grow from point A to point Z. They're really growing like crazy. It's a high quality chocolate, almost a nutritional chocolate food company. And so she's learning real things and getting paid for it and getting as much out of that experience because of the type of experiences as she could get easily out of the best business school in the country. Except she's getting the experience as well as the knowledge. So for an increasing number of people, particularly younger people, college may or may not be the right way to go. You got a science, technology, engineering, math, a so-called STEM degree. Yeah, do it. But if you don't have a defined reason, don't bother. I mean, just, you know, go out, get the experience, and push yourself.
It amazes me as I'm listening to you talk. I mean, backing it up to the last segment, you were talking about improving your life today. 8 years ago when I started this show, I put together a modern survival philosophy that drives everything we do. And number one on there is everything you do to prepare for emergencies, disasters, or economic turmoil should be blended into your life in such a way that improves your life even if nothing disastrous ever occurs. And this hits up on what you're talking about with education, because you and I, despite whatever educational backgrounds we have before we went into this world, are almost 100% self-educated on these problems. And yet we arrive at almost an identical philosophy to them, which proves that learning does not need to be uniform for the results to be very, very similar in their ability to actually function, solve problems, etc. And as I'm listening to you talk about this, the other similarity we have is our view of the education system. And I think if you'd like to add another E of something that's grown itself to the point where it can't grow anymore and it's going to fall in on itself, is education. It is an absolute preposterous disaster. The student loan bubble is one thing, but I mean, if you actually start thinking about a world shifting to where people can learn more on the internet in a week than they can learn in a college course in a month, and people start to actually apply that, whether there's a loan bubble or not, if people just stop going in the numbers that they're going, another infinite growth problem. The amount of capital that's been invested into these universities is astronomical. And once that cycle starts to slow down, I've said within 10 years, you'll see major universities closing their doors.
I agree. I would not want to be the president of a mid-tier liberal arts college right now. It's going to be a bitter fight to the swirling sound. You know, it's not going to be good. Because you're right. We've learned so much how people actually learn and studying in a classroom are not actually very well, matched up. We know how people learn. Like the military doesn't train you to go into Fallujah by having you read a book about it and then have you take a test on it, right? What do they do, right?
They
mock it up and you go through it because the military doesn't give a crud about, you know, what we've been doing for 100 years or more. They care about what works. What works is real simulations, real life action. That's where people learn stuff. The edgier, the better. Every culture has known that. We forgot it for a while as we were warehousing people for a factory existence that no longer exists. So it's just a crazy broken system. But that's, you know, I think, Jack, doesn't matter which orientation of the Rubik's Cube you have, which face you're looking at, you go, wow, this is kind of broken, needs fixing. Wow, broken, needs fixing. Politically, morally, you know, I can't even believe what's happened to our police and police systems and the level of moral decay that's implied by some of the things I see, you know, these cell phone videos have changed a lot in my life about how I view the world. And so this is all coming to a head. It's happening. And so the real question is, what can people do? And I love, you know, that you've got that philosophy that says, well, there's lots you can do, but you might as well do it both for what could happen tomorrow, but it should improve your life today. And that's exactly the same philosophy I ended up sort of finding on my own, I guess. Please don't take this the wrong way, but I think what you and I do, it's just common sense is how
no,
it feels.
No, I don't take that, but I did a show on common sense yesterday, so.
Oh, good.
I mean, it is common sense, but what I talked about yesterday with common sense is that common sense is no longer common because we've removed the learning mechanism whereby a person learns common sense. So, it makes me think of when my kid was in like second grade. He got in trouble one day, right? And when we found out what he got in trouble for, I thought it was preposterous. He had to stand on the line out at the playground because he got in trouble. Now, he's 26 now, so this is even going way back. Well, to find out what he got in trouble for, he and some other kids were throwing rocks. Not at each other. There was a woodlot by the edge of the playground. They were throwing rocks at trees. And they got in trouble for that. And I sit there and I look at that and I go, this makes no sense. But what does a child learn from throwing a rock? They learn an incredible amount about the mathematical computer that is their brain. Trajectory, rate, impact, repeatability, all of those things. So a child that grows up in a sanitized world can't have common sense because all of those types of things that are natural, real feedbacks that are part of innate human behavior. My grandson comes over here. I didn't tell him to throw rocks. He picks rocks up and he throws them, right? And as long as he's not throwing them at my birds or my window, go nuts. He threw one a couple weeks ago, Chris, into a bucket full of water, and it was a big rock, and he got splashed in the face with nasty water. My wife has a video. One time, he comes back over with another rock, and he kind of stands there and sets it in and leans back to make sure it's not, and then figures that out. So how can you have common sense if we sanitize that out of you from the time you're a child because we want to live in a world where nobody skins a freaking knee anymore? I think the number one thing that these teacup parents want is to put like the Band-Aid companies out of business. No one even can have a Band-Aid anymore because we can't get hurt, you know? And that to me has destroyed common sense as a commodity in our country, in our world, really.
I agree, and I really do mourn for the childhoods a lot of people aren't having. I have to, confession time. From the age of 12 to 15, my life was literally a daily running felony by today's standards.
Yeah.
I really fell in love with explosives. I made my own black powder. I put it into things that I won't mention because who knows who's listening. But I blew stuff up all the time.
I'm pretty sure the statute of limitations is up. I mean, one of the biggest mistakes my chemistry teacher did was teach me what happens when you pour hydrochloric acid on zinc. You get pure hydrogen you can put in a balloon, and we filled up all kinds of stuff with that and some model rocket engine igniters, and we blew a lot of holes in a lot of things. But you know what? We were smart enough not to blow ourselves up with it. We understood it. We kind of went slow. We did some things that were probably worse than that I won't mention because they may, in fact, not have a statute of limitations. But, I mean, I grew up, by the time I was 12 years old, I had a .22 rifle and I would just go up on the mountain with it. And no one freaked out. I'd walk through the neighbor's yard because it was a shortcut to the mountain. And if anything happened, they might wave you over to shoot a groundhog or something in their garden. Today, if a 12-year-old kid walked across the street with a .22, even where I grew up, I guarantee the cops would get called. And this is the insanity we live in. And people say, well, it's a different world today. But we're not different. The systems are different. The 12-year-old of today could be just as responsible as the 12-year-old of the 1980s. We've broken it. And that leads me to kind of the bigger problem I see here as I listen to you talk about all these systems. I've been saying it about education, and I've become more and more realizing the holistic nature of it. These systems cannot be fixed. They have to be rebuilt. And even if we all got on board today and everybody agreed that they needed to be rebuilt and we even had the best way possible to rebuild them and started now, it would still be a massively painful shift where I think what we're going to get into is different pieces at a time forced into rebuilding them.
Well, yeah, I guess I would only disagree if I could say that, if we actually had a true competitive free marketplace, I think it would be fantastic if,
sure.
Think about we have Common Core math came out, like the biggest disaster possible, like obviously designed by a committee, right? And it's foisted out, and presumably this committee studied a lot of things. I'm like, why wouldn't you just go to the number one country in the world on the education standard, Finland, and see what they're doing and model that? That seems cheap and easy, right? In fact, pick Denver or some nice city, put one of these schools in and run a trial and see who does better, right? Yeah. And just let the free market decide, and parents could decide, hey, I'd rather have my kid raised that way. That looks better. Or this way. But we don't. We have this monopoly of this is how education's done. And to your son's experience, really getting in trouble for throwing a rock, there's another lesson built into that, which is, oh my God, that level of risk is not tolerated, right?
Yeah.
But how does your son then connect that with the idea of just open any newspaper right on the front page, maybe, United States takes out wedding party with drone, right? So we're willing to tolerate an unbelievable amount of suffering and death outside of our country, but inside we're demanding complete safety. It's literally insane.
It is insane.
And to have that mindset.
And that's why I say there's the free market, I'm all for it. I'm for basically peaceful anarchy is what I would like to see in the world. But it ain't going to happen. And even I think at this point that the problems that we've created are so bad that even if we were proactively trying to solve them, and we're not, the shift is going to be painful. It has to be, because there's so much invested in systems that are careening toward failure, because as you said mathematically, they have to fail. If you look at public education. I'm going down to high school and grade school now. That system is reached kind of the limit of its growth curve. And like, this is amazing how much in sync we are. In my history segment today, I talked about Common Core math and how the purpose of Common Core math is to separate the child from the parent's ability to assist them with learning. That's the actual agenda, so that we're creating a protectionist environment, a bubble where teachers are special and you have to go to a teacher to learn how to add 2 + 2. It's in 97 steps or whatever. It's preposterous, but it's being done out of a protectionism because as the internet has evolved, as people have actually started to see what a homeschooled or unschooled or independent learning student looks like and accomplishes, it's beginning more and more popular. And every time you pull a butt out of a seat in public education, that school loses money. And if you start to look at the investment, the high school my son went to, they built it the year before he started going there, $65 million to build one high school. And the city we lived in had 6 of them.
Wow.
Empty one. Empty one and what happens? Empty two and what happens? And when you do empty those high schools, and the people that left do better than those that stayed behind, you create. So the free market you mentioned, we can't totally suppress the free market. Sooner or later, the market shows you the truth. And education, I think, is seeing that now, and it's creating that suction. And how are you going to convince a kid now to go out and indebt themselves for $80,000 to go to college? Like, that's the biggest false sales push that's ever been made, and it's finally wearing out. So I see like the whole thing just getting so like critical mass. You get so heavy, you can't move anymore.
Well, indeed. And, you know, what systems do is they always want to perpetuate themselves. That's just the nature of systems. Bureaucratic systems always seem to grow. You know, we always have more laws, not fewer, on any given year. And, that increasing complexity is just, you're right, it's going to drag itself down at some point. But the mystery to me is that the common sense approach should be, you know, all these parents who are hysterically involved in wanting their children to have the best possible experience in education. All they have to do is be curious for 10 minutes and ask what does really high quality education look like and how would we provide that, and then map that up against what their school is providing, and most people are going to find they do not have access to high quality education. What we know works. We know things today. We know how the brain works. We know about neuroplasticity and programming. We know how the importance of having curiosity and an edge experience and mentoring, so that, you know, think about that. We have these schools still which say, if you are between the ages of 12 and 13, this is your grade, and you're going to stay in that cohort for the whole experience. As humans, we're not wired for that. We're wired to learn from people who know more than us and then pass it on to people who know less than us. And that is an important part of that wiring process. And when kids have a chance to mentor those who are coming behind them, it's a phenomenal cementing experience that makes what they've learned theirs. And so I think you're right that, you know, that the idea that Common Core is there to separate the parents from the child. I think that even education in general separates the content from the learning, so that the kids just have a bunch of stuff that's not connected to anything. And it's still totally disempowering, because the point of school is not to create people who are free-thinking individuals who are in charge of their own destiny.
God forbid you do that. Then they might not accept your tyranny that you're placing over them in the name of protection. You mentioned the way of learning, and you mentioned the military earlier. I have to tell you, when I was in the military, show me how to do it was a training technique. So I might teach you as a new soldier how to tie a Swiss seat for rappelling. And you get it right, and it's good, and I inspect it. I said, untie it. Now show me how to do it. And even though I already know how to do it, the action of you teaching me reinforces the information. And our belief and our training was that if you show someone how to do something and their odds of being able to remember it and do it well are a 1, even if they drill it 100 times, if they teach it to someone else, the odds that they'll remember it and be proficient at it goes up by tenfold. And
exactly.
My experience, I've seen that. The more I teach, the more I actually retain, learn, and know and develop.
Exactly. And so we know this, and the military knows this, and the Romans knew this. But still, it's not part of the average curriculum out there, except in the best schools, like the very best schools. And so if you go to where the elite send their children, you won't find any of the regular junk that you see in a normal school, because they know that these people have to come out as leaders, and they need to have independent thought, and they need to be able to have tested themselves, and they have to understand how humans work. They need real education. So it's, again, there's just, you know, I understand not everybody can be, you know, a leader, an elite, and a CEO or a whatever, or a general, but this idea that we've got a whole lot of people who are either going to have a paycheck or be fundamentally adrift and not know what to do just doesn't feel like the right approach at this part time in history to me.
It's probably the worst time for it. I mean, it really is. Tell us a little bit more about your new book, where people can get it, and what they're going to learn in it.
Well, sure. The title is Prosper, with an exclamation point. You can find it on Amazon. You can get it at our site, peakprosperity.com. On Amazon, it's in Kindle form, hard book form. I also recorded the audiobook for it, so whatever mode people like to get it in, it's available all those places. Of course, bookstores. If you go there, we should be in most bookstores. So that's the book, and there is a companion guide to it, because we didn't want this book to be a gigantic, you know, encyclopedia. This is sort of the outline of everything, and then there's What Should I Do guide, which has a little more specific stuff. You know, when we say it's a good idea to store some food up, that's in the book. Where you might go about doing that and how is in the What Should I Do guide, found at our website at peakprosperity.com/whatshouldido.
On that note, another thing that I think is heading for some hard times is real estate, and there's places where it hasn't gotten any better yet. But I'm seeing places like where I live in Texas, one of the few economies that are still growing in the country, our real estate prices are getting stupid.
Yeah.
We have to sell my father-in-law's house because, unfortunately, he's in late-stage Alzheimer's to the point where he needs full-time care. And basically selling his house buys him a year of care at the best facility we could find. And we were like, I don't know if we can get 80 grand for this house at the top. And real estate agent came and looked at it yesterday. Said, don't fix it up. You'll never get your money back out of it. Leave it alone. The last one like this that listed here listed for 99.5 and sold for 101 because investors want these because of building restrictions in Mansfield now. And I was blown away. And she's like, it'll sell in a week. Just list it. End the problem and you know, take the money for your dad-in-law. And I know that doesn't make sense in this market. I know that. And it's only because with the crash that we had in 2008, we stopped building. And now we have people coming here and there's not new homes.
Well, there's a lot going on with that. Of course, the Federal Reserve rescued real estate prices for the boomers, completely shafting the next generation coming along. You know, so that was just an obvious generational sort of a trade-off. But, you know, real estate always is a function of, is there money in jobs and all of that. And so I'm a big believer that we're due for a recession here, if not a depression, depending on how things shake out. And real estate is one of the obvious asset areas where things are going to get clocked. But in Texas, also I'll throw North Dakota and Oklahoma into this mix. This oil downturn is now worse than the one in 1986. I know Texas has a more diversified economy that's going to help. But trust me, this is going to hurt. And it's just starting right now to really bite and pinch. And over the next year, you're going to see some real blood in the streets over what's happening in the oil patch.
Yeah, and I've seen that already. I have a friend who is in technology whose job was pretty easy. He would go out to all these remote facilities and, you know, swap routers out and stuff like that where the rigs were drilling and what have you. And he ended up late. You know, fortunately for him, he's good at what he does, and he found another job in like a week. But, you know, he had that job for like 6 years. And it had kind of taken it on the thought of, I'm going to do this for another 20 years and retire. Because it was easy. If you're doing work like that, nobody's bothering you because no one wants to go with you. And that is a symptom of that. Like the growth of that stopped. So since it's not growing anymore, you just don't need as many people to do maintenance on the networking equipment there. Pretty much you put a router in and you leave it alone. You don't need to do something with it every day. And most of that stuff that's done can be done remotely. So he was the guy that went out when something had to be done physically, and he's just not necessary anymore. And that's a directly related job because it's in that sector, but it's not the kind of person you think of as being hurt by an oil downturn. Because there's, you know, it's a networking person. It works on Cisco routers.
It's astonishing who gets hurt in an oil downturn. There's truckers, waitresses who are serving the truckers who are coming to the stops. There are people who sell sand, water, of course, all the people involved in the equipment that goes down the bore, all the drillers, the companies, it's a very big, it actually, you know, the tendrils go far. I would guess that for every $120,000 a year oil job, you probably lose two or three lesser jobs associated with it.
Think about this. So you mentioned 86. I have a good friend that ran a trophy shop in Houston, in 1986. Now you would think that's pretty divorced from oil and gas. When that oil and gas thing hit, it drove down, all of the companies that were in that sector and many of the supporting companies like you're talking about. Well, one of the first things they did was cut things they didn't need, like awards for their employees. And those types of, you think of a trophy shop, like for your kid that got a participation one for, you know, hey, maybe that's where that came from, right? but what happened is he lost like 40 to 50% of his business in the first year there because they just, you know, like, do we need to spend money on plaques or whatever? And, oh, wow, maybe that is why everybody gets a participation trophy now. It was the trophy industry adapting to the loss of the corporate jobs. Wow. But, I mean, you wouldn't think that a trophy shop would be suffering because of an oil downturn.
Yeah, these are the surprising things you learn. And so I that's one thing I would just like to alert any of your listeners to is that this downturn is really severe and it's picking up steam and I think it's going to get worse before it gets better here.
What's up with all this scuttlebutt I hear about no ships in the Atlantic? Is that legitimate? Is that overblown?
That's overblown.
It smelled overblown.
Yeah, the two sites that the people linked to and showed, indeed, they do show a lot of ships near shore and none out in the ocean, but that's because they were looking at the free side of the site. These companies don't offer all their information for free, so they were displaying ships within 40 miles of the coastline, but if you wanted to know where things were out in transit, that's part of their subscription service. So they just weren't looking at the full information block. Because, you know, people do like to track ships in the open ocean, particularly like, you know, if you've ordered a $100,000, critical CO2 extraction machine from China and you want to see where it's, you know, is it coming? You would of course pony up and be able to track your ship with your item on it.
Well, and part of what kind of irked me there was as soon as I heard Atlantic, I'm like, if we're talking about the Atlantic without talking about the Pacific, something's wrong. Cause most of the Chinese made stuff obviously comes in on the West Coast side of things. So it smelled enough like overblown that I didn't dig deeper into it. So I guess that's one good thing that we can discuss today.
Yeah, that's overblown. But obviously with the Baltic Dry Index, you know, crashing to all-time lows, you know, there's plenty of data out there that we don't have to stretch for that says, listen, we're in the grips of a very serious downturn right now.
Where do you see this oil market bottoming out and how quick before you have a snapback on it? I look at that too and go, that's not going to stay cheap. It just isn't, you know, like this is it for you, for people in my audience that are, you know, they store fuel and all. It's like, this is a good time to fill up all your reserve tanks right now.
Great time. It's going to go high. Listen, it could go lower for a while. The problem is that the world is basically oversupplied by about 1.5 million barrels per day right now.
Okay.
And that's sufficient. Like, how low can oil go when it's oversupplied? It could go to zero, literally. There's no technical bottom to this. Because what happens is, paradoxically, the lower the price of oil goes, the faster companies have to pump to get cash flow to service their debt so they don't go out of business, right? It's a survival instinct. Companies, if their choices include damaging their wells by overpumping them or going out of business, they'll overpump the wells. That's just how it works. But you're right. At $30 a barrel, the marginal cost of production, if I want to put a brand new well in anywhere in the Eagle Ford or the Bakken place for shale oil, or I want to fire up a new Suncor facility up there in the tar sands of Canada, or I want to do an ultra deep water on the shelf out in the Gulf of Mexico, those require a minimum of $80 a barrel, some 90, some 100, some 120, depending on the play. There's no way oil can stay below that marginal cost forever. I think it's going to stay down for a year, maybe two. But we're not investing. We, the world, are not investing in new oil, and all the existing oil fields are depleting. They're being poorly maintained at these prices. So in 2 or 3 years, we're going to find that we actually are going to have a fantastic shortfall, and so we'll see prices spike back up again. But guess what? huge amounts of debt hate high oil prices. So that's the world we're stuck in. There's a price of oil that's too high for the economy to afford, and there's a price that's too low for the oil companies to afford. And that band between too high and too low is squeezing together.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about this economy here being hit. The national economy of Russia, people don't think of Russia as an oil producer, but the Russian economy runs on oil. And $30 a barrel doesn't work for Russia. I mean, Russia's got a problem there right now, big time. The Russian economy needs about a $70 a barrel price to function well.
Well, they do. It's been softened a little bit because the ruble has collapsed so hard. So that softens it because they do a lot of their own internal manufacturing and they have a complete supply chain for the oil business inside. It would be a big problem if they had to buy drill bits and downhole bore tools from the United States. That would actually be a double bad whammy for them. But they're Russia, so they make their own stuff. Who's absolutely getting crushed, killed, destroyed by this is Venezuela, number one, Brazil, two. Saudi Arabia's got a big reserve, but they're getting absolutely just killed by this. So this is actually a pretty bad time right now for those countries. I think it's a slugfest, this pricing between Saudi Arabia and Russia. They're the number one and number two exporters in the world right now. So they're just – Putin's playing a game, and he's being pretty tough about it. And I think everybody thought he was going to blink, but he didn't. And it's really getting it's getting to the point something's got to give. Somebody's going to blow up on this. And, of course, you know, mid- and small-tier shale operators in the U.S. are blowing up right now. But, I mean, somebody big's going to blow up, some country. Don't know who yet.
Canada's got problems too. I mean, they did so much growth on that tar sands oil, and you don't make that for $30 a barrel either.
Oh God, no! That's the most capital intensive. That's horribly expensive oil to produce. And by the way, it's Western Canadian Select is the blend they sell. It's nasty stuff. It's actually called bitumen. It's not really oil, but anyway, it's they synthesize it. They do stuff to it. Call it Western Canadian Select. I like the Select. It's very nice name.
Yeah.
And that sold for $19 the other day. It should be down probably closer to $18 today based on this oil price. And so the whole Alberta economy is imploding right now. You thought, you know, Texas had a housing bubble. Calgary has a giant one. I advise people who are listening to me from up there, like, sell now. That was over a year ago. I was like, just get out. And it's really – Canada has some of the highest household debt levels. They've had an absolutely enduring housing bubble that never burst when ours did. So Canada's way over its ski tips on this one. And I think Canada's going to have, along with Australia, other resource countries, are going to have really hard times. So my advice to people listening from or living there is buckle up. It's going to get rough.
One of the things I took away from your crash course is how dire the energy problems are, not just from like lack of oil, but, you know, and eventually being too expensive to produce, but how inadequate what everybody thinks is going to save us really is as far as alternative energy, or even nuclear energy, being enough to replace what oil does. Can you talk about that a little bit here? Because I think that's something that a lot of people have a bit of a pie in the sky view of.
Yeah, pie in the sky. Thank you for the euphemism. I'll use that because it's just fantasy thinking at this point. And I wish, you know, after the Paris meeting, the COP21, and some leaders got together and signed a document that said we're going to be off fossil fuels by 2050. And I know people wrote me in like, ha-ha, it's solved.
Because if you put it on paper, it happens, right?
It's happened.
We can all agree. Unicorn, too. They just have to make a bill that says everybody gets a unicorn.
I know. So it's done. You know, woo, glad we can take that off our worry caps, you know. And I'm like, no, God, you gotta, oh my gosh. So just if you pull up a chart and you look at the contribution of alternative energy, and people send me these all the time, like, look, oh, solar's growing 100% a year. At this rate, it'll, in just 16 more doublings, it supplies 100% of our energy needs. And I just gotta sit them down. You pull out the bigger chart that says, look at the growth in renewables, alternative energy, but let's look at the total energy consumption. And you still have to squint to see renewables on that chart. Because yes, solar went up 100% last year, but coal went up 7%, right? It's coal is so much larger that 7% was vastly more than the 100% growth. And so we still, as a species, are a species that stumbled into a really rich food source. We're going to call it fossil fuels. That's coal, oil, natural gas. We're eating that stuff quite literally. And it's still, there's no possible way market forces, air quote time, market forces are going to deliver us enough Tesla cars and solar, photovoltaics to do anything other than give us a really crappy future. Now, if we were getting serious about this, if my country, if the president, sat down and said, listen, we've got X number trillion feet of natural gas in the ground. We're pretty sure we can get it out. We've got X billion barrels of oil. How would we like to use that? What kind of a future would we build towards? What do we have to install? What would we have to do to revamp our transportation system? If we had done those sorts of things, like any competent business would, like I have a strategy, right? Where am I going? How am I going to get there? And that's what a strategy is. We don't have a strategy for anything other than, we're going to keep, using oil, and people should just buy more SUVs because those make GM happy, and that's our plan. It's not a plan, and we're never going to shift from something beautiful and tasty like fossil fuels, which are energy dense. They have remarkable characteristics. They explode at just the right temperatures, but not at the other ones. They're just wonderful. That we're going to go from concentrated, highly dense energy sources to a diffuse energy source, which is the wind and solar, right? Those are diffuse energy sources. Humans have never gone that direction before. We've always gone from a worse to a better energy source, from a less concentrated to a more concentrated energy source. We went from wood to coal because coal was better. We went from coal to oil because oil was better. To go from oil to sun, whoops, that's going way back down. We're going the other direction on this. I'm not saying we can't do it, but let's get our heads out of the clouds. To do it, it's going to require massive investments, real changes to how we do things, and we're going to have to get started on it probably 10 years ago. But even today, if we did, we need a Manhattan Project times an Apollo Project times a big number to get this done, and that's what it's going to be required, and we're not doing it. So since we're not doing it, I'm going to predict it ain't going to get done, at least not in the way people are hoping.
No, and I mean, my question for people that get pie in the sky about that is always, I want you to go do it. Nobody's ever come back with the number, by the way, but I want you to do a research project. I want you to figure out how many 100-watt solar panels it would take to provide enough energy to make one more 100-watt solar panel a day if every part of the construction process of that solar panel had to come from solar energy.
That's the key question. And that's a great question.
I have no idea what the number is, but it's probably pretty dadgone big. Until you can build solar panels with solar panels, solar is not viable as a replacement for fossil fuel. All a solar panel is a whole bunch of fossil fuel imbibed energy that slowly releases it back. And I guess you could look at the payback time on it on an energy standpoint and kind of calculate the number that I just gave you, said. But I don't think that would really be accurate because it's dishonest, because what else goes with energy economy? And the cost, the actual cost of some of this stuff, we don't actually see all the energy inputs, what it really takes to extrude wires and things like that. I mean, it would be a really interesting number to know, I think.
It'd be fascinating to know, and it would be also scary, and because it would really prove that it's probably not a viable, at least not as the economy is configured, it's not viable. I think we could have a life built around that, but it would be very different from today. Let's of all the peaks that I categorize, Jack, I think we're at peak easy, Fossil fuels just make it easy, and nobody wants to give the easy up. And I read these things as impassioned, here's what we have to do to combat climate change, even by James Hansen, the guy who's, the NASA guy, he's willing to get arrested and all that stuff. But when he has the opportunity to write in the New York Times, he never says what has to be said, which is, listen, to really put less carbon in the atmosphere, we have to be willing to take a 50% hit to our lifestyles, our ease of life. Things are going to get a little harder, but this is something, and whether I'm not saying we should do this or not for climate change, but the level of failure to really be honest about this is startling to me. And it's just math, right? It's just, I could put up a million solar panels on my house tonight, and I still can't run my car on them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we still can't run a jumbo jet on them. And, we still can't run a container ship on them. And we still, on and on and on. So there's a lot that needs to be done, and we're not doing it. Which
people have no idea how much energy they use to boil enough water to make a couple cups of tea.
Right.
Well, especially when that energy is electric or propane or natural gas, because it's so simple, you don't really think about how much energy you're using. And the people that are for alternatives would say, well, with a rocket stove and some sticks, you can do the same thing. I agree. I own a rocket stove. I have made coffee and tea with sticks. It ain't as easy. I don't do it every day. If I had to, I would. I'd probably drink less tea or coffee if I had to, but you have a certain level of convenience that has to be given up to be able to make these alternative energies that we have available to ourselves for now useful. Do I think that we'll ever get to a point in our evolution where we can produce the type of convenient energy we have in a clean, sustainable way? If we don't kill ourselves first, yes. But I don't think I'll live to see it. I really don't. I plan on living to be an old man.
I don't think we're going to see it either. And the reason is because it's not because it can't be done. It's because we won't do it. And that's the difference between we already have the technology we need. We just don't have the right narrative. And so here's a prime example. The sun, I'm not real crazy about the sun making electricity yet. I've got photovoltaic panels for other reasons, but I'm not, But the sun heats stuff up great. Right? I love my solar thermal panels. I have a little 100-watt circulating pump, and because that pump puts fluid up into these black panels on my roof, I have 260 gallons of piping hot water, you know, almost all the time. And that's fantastic. So this makes great financial sense. The payback on this system is just fantastic, about an 8-year payback, and a 25-year lifespan. So it's got like a 100% internal rate of return. Great investment. If I care about putting carbon in the atmosphere, great. It doesn't put any carbon in the atmosphere once they're installed. I have two teenage daughters. They can shower as long as they want. I don't even care. You know, all the hot water you want, have at it. So I love these things. Now, this is not sexy technology, Jack. It's from 1970s. It's a box with some pipes in it, right? Mm-hmm. These should be on every single roof where it makes sense. And then we wouldn't be heating water with either coal through electricity or natural gas or oil. Like we should be doing that.
Atoms to make a cup of tea, because that's another thing we're doing.
Exactly.
There is a lot of nuclear energy in America, but I mean, that's another place I think people have like this Pollyanna look at things. Like, how long has it been since we've built a nuclear plant in America?
Well, it's been a while. I know they have one that's a pair in Georgia that have been way behind schedule and over budget. You know, color me surprised. Yeah. But it's been a while. But even if we did that technology, there's not enough known deposits of uranium in the world to service a vast increase in our plants. China's got 36 coming online, and they've scoured the world for the uranium supplies they need for that. So, yeah, the only technology I'm kind of intrigued by is the thorium reactors, of which we built the only two known prototypes in the 50s and early 60s here in America. We haven't touched them since because, you know, one of their drawbacks of a thorium reactor is that they don't make plutonium. It's useful in bombs. They don't have any military aspect.
They don't melt down either. And have you ever really thought about the irony of this? A nuclear power plant is designed to use an extremely risky and complex and toxic fuel source to boil water.
Yeah.
That's all it really does is boils water, and it's that is then used to turn that into electricity. Now, I don't know if this is true or not. My understanding of a thorium reactor is if something goes wrong, it just kind of stops. It doesn't go Fukushima on you.
It's true. If it burns through the plug at the bottom, it falls out into a large pool holding container, and it freezes up. It turns solid. That's it. That's all that happens. The technologies, I've had Kirk Sorensen on a couple times, and you know, we've discussed them. They make a lot of sense. And in fact, I think it was Malaysia just inked a deal with a U.S. company that's got some design plans to actually begin investigating building thorium plants in their country. China's got a big thorium reactor plant program ongoing with over 150 PhDs dedicated to it. India's investigating it because India needs more energy badly. Mark my words, in 10 or 15 years, the United States is going to be on its knees buying this technology from other countries. It's just painful to watch.
Probably. So, well, I think we've depressed people enough. You want to finish up with maybe just a little bit of some words of encouragement on building resiliency in your life?
Well, listen, I've done it, and Adam's done it. I'll tell you from my own experience, my quality of life, Jack, is fantastic now. I'm in better shape. I've got really great relationships. I'm surrounding myself with functional beauty in my own homestead. That's the approach I've taken. I feel actually myself, I'm really fairly positive about both my prospects and those of my children. So this is a program of that you get on. It's, you know, resilience isn't something you achieve. It's a state of mind. It's a journey. You know, it's not a thing you go out and buy. And so I've really loved this path. And I'll tell you, if my house, you know, somehow got taken from me or burned down tonight, I would recreate everything I've got as fast as possible, because this is really an important thing in my own life. And I've made my own peace with the fact that, you know, the world is going to do what it's going to do, and people are going to have to learn the hard way. It just seems to be the way of the world. And I'm convinced there is a giant, you know, financial accident coming that will wake people up in various points and stages. And when that happens, I plan to be among those, maybe the few, who are going to be in a position to help people rather than be requiring help from people when that happens. So to me, Jack, becoming resilient, becoming prepared is a selfless act. It's not a selfish act. And I wish more people understood it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I've always said that people look at any of us who are prepared and think of us as hoarders. And the reality is hoarding and those things are what happens during a disaster when there's not enough for everybody and everybody goes and sucks up the resources that are there. By having things in storage, by having reserves, you actually take yourself out of that cycle and you're not part of the problem when the problem is at critical mass. And I think it's, you know, my goal has been basically to create a culture of preparedness in America. And that's really what you're talking about as well. We might use different words, but it's the same type of thinking. There's two things that I look at in people's lives that I want to instill. One is self-reliance and one is self-sufficiency. And I think we measure one in time and one in percentage. And very few of us ever get to be 100% of one or have duration of self-reliance where we can go 10 years to wait out, you know, a crisis like you mentioned in Africa. So we have to have interaction with other people. And that's why I like seeing you bring in, you know, things like social capital, because that is how we're going to have to navigate through this thing, because we're not going to do it alone and we're not going to do it as isolationists. And sooner or later, these problems, I think we're going to have to correct them. We're going to have to rebuild these systems, and it may take total crisis for that to happen. And somebody's got to have their shit together, for lack of a better term, when that happens, to help others do it that have no clue. Because I think we would agree the majority of people will start thinking about this only when it's painful enough to make them.
Right. Right. And that's, you know, to be expected, I guess. It's unfortunate, but it's how it seems to have to work out. But, you know, I will say that the awareness is growing. I had, you know, last month I was speaking at wealth conferences where there may have been upwards of 200 to 300 billion under management in the room. And people at that level, very concerned about what they see. Mm. And of course they've got access to pretty good information on how the financial systems work. They're all worried. Of course they are. We've created this monstrous system, and it, you know, it can't hold. And so the only question then becomes, what are you going to do about that? And to everybody who's going to wait until they read about it above the fold in the New York Times before they get busy, they're going to be disappointed.
Yeah.
Very disappointed. Better a year early than a day late to this story.
Absolutely. So one more time, give a plug for your book and your website and everything you got going on over there.
Love to. So the website is peakprosperity.com. That's P-E-A-K, like a mountain peak. And we've got a great subscription service there and just a wonderful crew of people who are talking about these things. And the book is Prosper with an exclamation point, subtitle, How to Prepare for the Future and Create a World Worth Inheriting. Again, you can find that anywhere, Amazon, local bookstores, and at Peak Prosperity.
And you guys do a podcast too, right?
We do. I've got, you know, all kinds of podcasts that we do, a weekly one, and then one also for insiders, which is just off the cuff, where we just talk with somebody who's interesting and about whatever's going on.
And we'll let people know now, I'm going to be on your show a little bit later this month.
That's correct, and can't wait to have you on and reverse this and ask you questions.
I'm looking forward to it, Chris. And thank you for being with us today, and thank you for the work that you've been doing for a long time. Since I've been kind of parallel to you in timeline, I know how much work goes into it, and it's a lot of work, but it's important work. Somebody has to do it, because very few people, I think, really are willing to do this work. There's a lot of people that are willing to do it for themselves, but everything I do, I don't know about you, but everything I do takes longer because I make sure that other people are informed about it and how to do it.
Fantastic. Well, again, thank you, and thank you for the work you're doing. We need many more of us out there besides, I think, to continue this as well.
Yeah, there's room in the pool for everyone to jump in that wants to help, man. With that, again, thank you for being on the show today, Chris. And with that, it's been Jack Spirico today, along with Chris Martinson, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
So we gotta make the most of our one night together. Breaking out of my body and flying away like a bat.